This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Just 6 years ago, President Barack Obama won North Carolina's vote in his first presidential election, and for a culturally conservative southern state, that came as a surprise to many. The state is now controlled entirely by Republicans, another surprise in a region once known as the Solid South for its monolithic control by the Democratic Party. But as our history tells us, North Carolina has always been surprising politically. Tom Amon is a professor of political science at East Carolina University and the author of the new book, The Making of a Southern Democracy. The book traces the political history of North Carolina from Carr Scott to Governor Pat McCrory. Tom Amon joins us right now to talk about his book. Tom, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. I've always admired your program a lot. And delighted to be with you, Frank.
It's great to have you here, and what a wonderful book, this complex history of North Carolina, which you start in the 1940s. So give us the landscape, the political landscape in North Carolina when you begin your book in the 40s.
It was a different world, and that's why I started then. Interestingly, by 1950, the end of the decade of the 40s, many modern conveniences and technology had worked themselves into the state and into the country. For example, we saw the advent of television about that time, and from about 1948 or 9 to 1950, it went from a store window curiosity into a common feature in houses. Also, we had air transportation with connections to places all over the world and direct flights from places like Greensboro, Raleigh, Durham, and Charlotte to New York and Washington. The car was a standard means of transportation. So we were in the modern world. And yet, socially, we were in a different world. I like to say that our social system then, especially with regard to relations between blacks and whites, very much resembled the apartheid system in South Africa. Our Constitution, perhaps, was very noble in its aims, and the 14th and 15th Amendment had extended rights of citizenship to African Americans. Furthermore, the Declaration of Independence said, all men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, including life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That, of course, meant certain people. It meant men. But we believe then as Americans,
white
people
men.
Of all races were taught that.
Meant white men, but go ahead.
White men, yeah. Absolutely. And so this is an interesting period to start because it's the old world and the new world. Technologically, we've moved into the new world, but in terms of politics and the society in general, it's an old world and a very backward world at that.
And the South had always identified itself as a place that could keep the world from encroaching on it. Certainly that was the genesis of the Civil War,
yes.
Jim Crow that had persisted through the most of the 20th century up until then was over and against what was happening in the rest of the country. How is North Carolina different from, first of all, the rest of the country, but also the rest of the South? It really stood out as a kind of unique feature of the national landscape and even the southern landscape, didn't it?
In modern times, or even semi-modern times, let's say from the beginning of the 20th century, from around 1900 on. Now, earlier on, Frank, the South was known, or the state was known, as the Rip Van Winkle State, the state that had gone asleep. It was a pretty backward place in the 1800s. But there were a lot of innovations around 1900. Unfortunately, a number of these innovations came right in the aftermath of bloodshed. Governor Aycock, who I learned was North Carolina's George Washington in many respects. We didn't have Washington or Jefferson, but we had Aycock. He was elected governor in 1900, and he was long remembered as the great education governor. In fact, he was the great education governor in a sense. But he was also an ardent racist and had participated in a movement to take away from African Americans what rights they did have. And there had been progress right after the Civil War. And up until the late 1800s, many blacks voted in North Carolina. and served in the legislature. But then that was all stamped out in the 1898-1900 period, and Aycock was part of that. So the paradox of Aycock is that he was indeed a great believer in education. His last word before he died of a heart attack was education, but at the same time, he was a racist. However, one would have to say that it was Aycock that put North Carolina on the road for universal education, and he was very interested not only in elementary and secondary, but also in college and university education. After that, we had a series of great innovators, both governors and others, and of course, the great president of the UNC system, Dr. Frank Porter Graham, who would figure into politics in other ways.
One of the ways in which North Carolina was very similar to other southern states was in the monolithic control of the Democratic Party in the aftermath of the Civil War, owing to the fact that Lincoln was a Republican, right? The solid South.
This is very true. Right? And interestingly enough, there were areas of North Carolina that did not want to withdraw from the Union at that particular point. And you find that especially in the mountains, but occasionally in some Piedmont counties like the area around Asheboro. And those counties started voting Republican in the aftermath of the Civil War, but to express their displeasure with the Democrats who were in control. And interestingly enough, that Republicanism in the mountains and in other pockets around the state remains even today. And so perhaps they are still Republicans, and it's a result of being loyalists in the Civil War, loyalists to the Union, even though over a period of time, of course, the parties would change drastically.
This paradox that you point out in Charles Aycock is seen throughout North Carolina politics. A figure like Sam Ervin, who is seen to the nation at large as a great progressive and the hero of Watergate, had a lot in common with his Republican counterpart, Jesse Helms, in that they were both ardent segregationists.
Yes. And when the whole question of the Martin Luther King holiday came up, Helms, of course, was one of the leading opponents of that, achieved a lot of notoriety in a lot of circles from that. But one of his most ardent supporters was then former Senator Sam Ervin of North Carolina, who had been a great hero of the liberals, even though he was conservative, because he had played a big role. Ervin had played a big role in bringing down the Richard Nixon administration after Watergate. But the Helms staff members told me that Senator Ervin was on the line just about every day to Jesse Helms during the controversy, the debate over the Martin Luther King holiday, making suggestions about how it would be blocked. And they said Helms appreciated the support tremendously, but he got so tired of dealing with all the calls that former Senator Ervin was making that he finally started leaving instructions to say he was out of the office when he called.
What causes this in the state of North Carolina, this tension between social progressivism, and we'll talk about that because you have a lot of characters, individuals, and you talk about their personalities, Jim Hunt being one, Terry Sanford being another, these Democrats who were socially progressive and also had some power in the state. This kind of social progressivism, but also this deep strain of conservatism. What's going on in this state that makes it different?
What makes North Carolina different? Well, Frank, I think you've hit the nail on the head in a lot of respects. There is this progressivism in a certain way. And I think there are probably a couple of factors anyway that would go there. One, you have long had a strain of populism in the state. And we think perhaps of different kinds of populism. Economic populism, however, is progressive, believing in more equality for people in general, whatever their economic backgrounds, innovative, give the common individual a chance to move ahead, to progress to the maximum of his or her ability. So you have that, and that's a reason I think we saw a great expansion in education, including the college and university level in North Carolina. So all that is reflected in the state's heritage. In addition, however, I think giving credit where credit is due, we have had some very progressive business leaders in North Carolina. I know often that as social scientists, we look at business leaders as maybe being elitist, having held back progress in a lot of ways. But in the case of North Carolina, we've had business leaders who perhaps were conservative in a lot of their basic instincts about politics, but at the same time wanted the state to forge ahead and were very strong supporters of education. And we can think of a project right in here in central North Carolina, the Research Triangle Park. And that was really the dream child of major business leaders such as George Watts Hill in Durham and the Haynes family of Winston-Salem and Archie Davis from there, combined with Governor Hodges, who was the ultimate representative of the business community in the governorship of North Carolina.
Well, Tom, I want to talk more about that after the break. Tom Eamon is a professor of political science at East Carolina University and the author of The Making of a Southern Democracy. And our conversation will continue on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking with Tom Eamon, a professor of political science at East Carolina University. He's the author of the new book, The Making of a Southern Democracy. The book traces the political history of North Carolina from Carr Scott to Governor Pat McCrory. And before the break, we were talking about the history of progressivism in North Carolina businesses. And Tom, you point this out, that there's actually a tension even within that business progressivism that, on the one hand, they wanted to educate the population to run the factories, and that's a progressive impulse. But on the other, they also didn't want an organized labor force. And so, you know, maybe being a little bit gentle and coming up with progressive ideas on their own in that regard, in regard to the workplace, would stave off the possibility of unions.
Good point, Frank. They hated labor unions. However, the euphemism that was often used to attract outside business was to say, euphemism for saying no labor unions, always the words were in advertising, North Carolina, a good labor climate. Everybody knew what a good labor climate meant. That meant no labor unions or very weak labor unions. And so the elites would argue, and there was a lot of self-interest, of course, in their arguments. There's self-interest in all our arguments, probably about everything, but there was a lot of self-interest there. But they said, as a result of not having labor unions, we will attract a lot of businesses into the state that would not be attracted otherwise. And that certainly included some low-paying industries such as textiles, but also over a period of time, many much better-paying industries also wanted as much flexibility with their labor force as they could get. And so North Carolina did eventually get some very high-paying businesses that wanted to keep labor unions out of their workforce, and they knew by coming to North Carolina, as opposed to being in Michigan or Ohio, that they would have not to contend. They would not have to contend with labor unions.
You talk about in your book certainly the trends, watershed elections, and also personalities that shaped the state politically, particularly in the aftermath of World War II. Let's talk about some of them. Terry Sanford, a very progressive individual who doesn't believe in segregation, preaches against it publicly. He's very enthusiastic about improving education in the state. How does somebody like him, there are certainly people in the state who felt that way, but he rises to the highest level of view, becomes governor of the state. What's going on, and how does he become successful in politics?
Well, from very early on, I'm sure from when he was in college, he dreamed of being governor of North Carolina, perhaps dreamed of being more than governor of North Carolina. So this was a goal for him from the very beginning. But he was very careful in working himself up. He was from Fayetteville. He was active in politics there. He was certainly a progressive even then on a lot of the economic types of issues we're talking about. However, at that particular point, he hid his racial views to some degree. He said that he was for equality, but he also said that he was for segregation. And when a particular plan was proposed to keep the schools segregated, called the Pearsall Plan, which wasn't the bitter end, say, never, never plan, such as Alabama and Mississippi were adopting, but it was sold to the state as a program to keep the schools segregated, Terry Sanford bought this. He supported it. He campaigned for it. Later on, he said he was doing it as a holding action. Even when he was running for governor, he said that he thought that most people in North Carolina favored segregation, and he thought that both blacks and whites would be happy with that. Obviously not his true feeling in the long run, but besides this, Terry Sanford simply knew how to identify with the people. He wasn't a magnetic speaker, to put it mildly. When he was campaigning, he would actually come on the radio in his ads, and he would start out, "This is Tara Sanford. I believe that quality education is the most important issue facing the voters of North Carolina today. If you agree with me, vote Tara Sanford in the upcoming Democratic primary." And then there would be a campaign jingle, "The man on the go for the state on the go, that's Terry Sanford. There's a new day coming, so for your next governor, vote for Terry Sanford." Well, this is not anything compared to what we see in campaigns today in terms of its sophistication, but yet it's something that went over very well with a lot of the voters of that time. They were not necessarily looking for the most dynamic orator. They were looking for someone who, I could say, he's one of us, in a sense. And Terry Sanford filled this role very well. And then in the runoff, where the Democratic nomination was then tantamount or the same as election in North Carolina, and the top candidate in the first primary had been Sanford, and Beverly Lake, who was a staunch segregationist, also a very sophisticated person in many respects, very dignified, very polished speaker, but a staunch segregationist, and he was Sanford's opponent. And then Sanford campaigned on the idea that Lake was an extremist and that Lake also would actually inflame the situation and that it might make the federal government more willing to get involved in pushing for integration if Lake were elected, and so that he, Sanford, would be the safer candidate than Lake would be. And we all know when he actually got into office that he played a major role in forging the state ahead, though part of this was in response to various civil rights demonstrations in the state, and Sanford knew that the state was under pressure to do something. He didn't want a bloodbath, and so he was, through the establishment of the so-called good neighbor councils, able to bring a lot of blacks and whites together.
Now, you said this was tantamount, the Democratic nomination, tantamount to election. That changes with the election of 1972. Things begin to change, and the lock of the Democratic Party is broken.
Yes, indeed, there are hints of change in the 1950s. President Dwight Eisenhower, elected president in 1952 and 1956, was a Republican, and he made some inroads into the South. He did not carry North Carolina, but he did very well in North Carolina and actually ran well in some of the large cities of North Carolina, notably Charlotte, Greensboro, and Winston-Salem. So there were inroads at that point. And then at various points through the 1960s, the Republicans continued off and on to make gains in the state. But as you just pointed out, Frank, 1972 was a really important year and perhaps something we would want to talk about.
Talk about that, yes, please.
Well, first of all, 1972 was a year that the Democrats nominated an extremely unpopular national candidate, a very honorable individual, and certainly someone who had the courage of his convictions. But his name was George McGovern, but he was far to the left of most North Carolina voters and most American voters in general when it came to what the policy should be on areas like amnesty for Vietnam War protesters or people who had evaded the draft, on the question of drugs. And some called him the candidate of the three A's, acid, abortion, and amnesty. This did not go over well with the typical American voter, nor with the typical North Carolina voter. He carried Massachusetts, and he carried the District of Columbia. His opponent, interestingly, Richard Nixon — this was after the Watergate offenses had been committed, but we didn't know about them at that particular time. Nixon won by a landslide in the nation over 60%, and Nixon got, as a Republican, remember, 71% in North Carolina. So this is something that strengthened the Republican ticket in general. And now we come to what happened in North Carolina, where it was a historic election. The Republican candidate for the United States Senate was Jesse Helms, and the Republican candidate for governor was Jim Holzhauser. They were very different kinds of Republicans. Helms had already become very well known as a television commentator in Raleigh, and he was probably the leading spokesman for conservatism, both on economic matters and social matters such as race in the United States. He was an individual, interestingly enough, who was very pleasant in his private conversations with individuals. His critics sometimes said he can give you a pat on the back when he meets you on the street and then slit your throat at night. But Jesse Helms was a man who certainly, agree with him or disagree with him, had the courage of his convictions. Under most circumstances, he would have been too far right wing to win in North Carolina. But in 1972, he faced a divided Democratic Party. Ultimately, the nominee of the Democratic Party had been Nick Galifianakis from Durham. Galifianakis was of Greek background. He had a moderate, not a liberal, but a moderate voting record in Congress. But Helms was able, or his campaign was able, to portray Helms as the really more American of the individuals. And one of the slogans in that campaign was, "Vote Jesse Helms, he's one of us," as though to suggest a man with a name like Galifianakis was not one of us. And so that had appeal, and also this was the time when a lot of the White South was very angry because of recent gains of blacks in terms of civil rights. There had been a lot of demonstrations. The major civil rights acts were having an influence in the state, and also busing for purposes of integrating schools had become really big in Charlotte and some other areas. And so there were a lot of angry white people, and they expressed their frustration ultimately by voting for Jesse Helms for the United States Senate. In the same year, Jim Holzhauser, the Republican, who was from Boone in the mountains and came from a long line of Republicans. Helms had just recently converted to the Republican Party in terms of registration, but Holzhauser was one of those mountain Republicans. He was very moderate in terms of his political philosophy. The Helms and Holzhauser campaigns had virtually nothing to do with one another during the entire campaign. But Holzhauser also, in large part due to the Nixon landslide, was able to win and then established a reputation as a governor very similar to what progressive Democrats such as Terry Sanford and others had. And he was a major leader in promoting environmental legislation, for example. But Helms, of course, moved to the Senate, and he immediately set out to learn the rules, and he became one of the most important figures in the American conservative movement in the entire 20th century and, of course, served in the United States Senate for 30 years.
Well, there we go. The second half of the 20th century, as turbulent as ever for the state of North Carolina. And if you go back before that, you'll find elements of these paradoxes and tensions all the way through. That brings us to today, 2008. Barack Obama takes the state, the southernmost state taken by the Obama campaign, a surprise to many that this state would go for Obama. In 2012, he actually gets more votes than he got in 2008 in North Carolina, but didn't take this state. It was a close race. And by all accounts, if you read the national media, you will see a state legislature that is portrayed as very far to the right, extreme rightist control of the state of North Carolina. Where are we now? Is it a purple state? Is that who we are, the state of North Carolina? Is this farther to the right than the state has been comfortable with in its history?
You raise a number of interesting questions, Frank. First of all, if you're taking the state as a whole, we are a purple state, I would say. We're one that can go either way. Obama, as you point out, narrowly carried the state in 2008, largely on the basis of strength in urban areas, and partly also because he had not only a solid, solid vote from African Americans, but he did better among white voters in 2008 than had earlier Democrats. Obama got 35% of North Carolina's white vote in 2008, whereas 4 years earlier, John Kerry, the Democratic nominee, even with John Edwards of North Carolina as his running mate, got only 28% of the white vote in North Carolina. So we see the tremendous change in where also the big cities in North Carolina, some that had in earlier years been Republican, actually voted heavily for Obama. For example, Mecklenburg County, Charlotte, by 100,000 votes. So Obama showed that it could be done. He made the effort that no other Democrats would have made at that particular time in North Carolina, Democrats running for president. At the same time, in 2008 and 2012, the great majority of the seats on the 7 or 8 member council of state, depending on how you look at it, whether you include the lieutenant governor, but the other top state elected officials, 5 of the 7 are Democrats also. So in statewide races, North Carolina does seem to have moved from a Republican-leaning state, at least in presidential elections, into a state that is very closely divided. However, the Republicans got a great, great break as a result of winning the elections of 2010, because the census is taken every 10 years, and the Democrats have been able to reapportion the North Carolina legislature for a century. This time, the Republicans were able to do that in 2011 after the 2010 census, and it was more or less payback time. They had been mistreated by the Democrats. There's no question about that. And now it was the Republicans' turn. And in 2012, if you actually take the total number of votes that were cast for Congress in North Carolina, the Democrats won 51% of the vote. But yet, when it came to the actual number of seats being carried by a particular state, of course, it was the Republicans who won, and not only won, but they won overwhelmingly, carrying 9 seats to 4 for the Democrats.
So there we see the shift. But where are we now? And for instance, let's ask the question this way. Where does Pat McCrory fit in this story of North Carolina?
Well, Pat McCrory, like President Obama, has had a very rough time during the last year. There are a lot of tensions within the Republican Party. In addition to that, there are obviously a lot of Democrats that are extremely unhappy that will be out to get him. And it's a bit early, way too early, to make predictions for 2016. But when that particular election is held, something we have to keep in mind is that McCrory will have to face the voters as a whole. And so while perhaps right now he has moved more to the right on the political spectrum, when the election comes, it would seem to me to have a really serious chance of being reelected that he's going to need to move more, on certain issues anyway, toward a centrist position, because he's going to have to appeal to the same electorate that has been favorable or mildly favorable to other statewide Democrats in recent elections, where, for example, in races like for Secretary of State, the Democrats have won, and where the President Obama narrowly lost the state the last time, lost it just by a couple of percentage points, and narrowly won it the time before. And so that's the electorate that Governor McCrory will need to face. And I'm sure he is well aware of that.
Tom, what a great pleasure talking with you, and a terrific book and a story well told. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Great to be with you.
Tom Amon is a professor of political science at East Carolina University. Tom Amon spells his name E-A-M-O-N, and he is the author of the new book, The Making of a Southern Democracy, North Carolina Politics, from Carr Scott to Pat McCrory. He's going to be reading at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. For more information, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up next, transforming food in public schools with the Cafeteria Man. Stay tuned.